Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love him. For he who spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And you may open the mind of Christ this morning, first of all, to 2 Kings 10. Thanks to Tom Mitchell and Michael Probasco for an excellent job on today's Eucharist as Eric and Tammy are out of town. That was a very stirring number, Michael. Fired up and ready to go now. I want to review for a moment to orient you to where we are in our study, for we are in the midst of something. And I want to remind you that we really are in Revelation 16, studying the frog demons. The frog demons are ambassadors sent out by Lucifer, as well as the demon that indwells the false prophet, to the various capitals of the nations of the Far East, those to the north, those in Western Europe, those to the south in Arabia, to accumulate their armies in the environs of Jerusalem. The major objective for Lucifer actually is twofold. He wants to solidify his global power and hopes to accomplish that with his armies on the battlefield. But in doing so, he hopes to eliminate the Jew from history, thus circumventing the Second Advent. He's not going to accomplish this, we know, by prophecy, but nevertheless, he will give it a go. He rehearses these things during the church age when he is restrained, he and his demonic armies are restrained, by the presence of the Holy Spirit in the souls of believers. And as soon as the Holy Spirit is withdrawn at the rapture, then he will be able to accomplish his objectives with a great deal of efficacy and will make great progress until the Lord puts a stop to it at the Second Advent. But in the Old Testament, we're noting some illustrations of how these things work. The demon influence of ambassadors that are spread out through the capital cities of the ancient world, of which Israel and its divided monarchies were parts. The northern kingdom based at Samaria with a summer palace at Jezreel, and the southern kingdom at Judah. The northern kingdom is being ruled by Jeroboam, while the southern by his nephew Ahaziah. I want to remind you of a prophet, not only a prophet, but a prophecy by a prophet that is given in 2 Kings 10 that warns these individuals that they will not last much longer because of their tawdry ways, their ridiculous behaviors, and their worship of idols in the Baal cult. 2 Kings 10, verses 1 and following. Now, Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. These are Jehoram's sons and their sons, and possibly the sons of some of Jehoram's unnamed daughters. And Jehu wrote letters and sent them to Samaria to the rulers of Jezreel, the elders and the guardians, and the children of Ahab, saying, "And now when this letter comes to you, since your master's sons are with you, as well as the chariots and horses and a fortified city and the weapons, select the best and the fittest of your master's sons and set him on his father's throne and fight for your master's house." But they feared greatly and said, "Behold, the two kings, Jehoram and Ahaziah, did not stand before him. How then shall we stand?" And the one who was over the household, the palace in Samaria, and the one who was over the city, Samaria, the elders and the guardians of the children at Jezreel, sent word to Jehu, saying, "We are your servants. All that you say to us we will do. We will not make any man king. Do what is good in your sight." And then Jehu wrote a letter to them a second time, saying, "If you're on my side, and you will listen to my voice, take the heads of the men, your master's sons, and come to me at Jezreel tomorrow about this time." Now the king's sons, 70 persons, were the great men of the city who were rearing them. This story here is the fulfillment of a prophecy that was given by the prophet Elijah. And we see that in 2 Kings 9, verses 1 and following. Elisha the prophet called one of the sons of the prophets and said to him, "Gird up your loins and take this flask of oil in your hand and go to Ramoth Gilead. When you arrive there, search out Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in and bid him arise from among his brothers and bring him to an inner room. Then take a flask of oil and pour it on his head and say, 'Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel.' Then open the door and flee and do not wait." And then in Kings 9:7 we see the rest of the story. This is the protege of Elisha speaking to the now anointed King Jehu. King anointed, not king reigning quite yet. "And you shall strike the house of Ahab your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants and the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab every male person, both bond and free, in Israel. And I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. And the dogs shall eat Jezebel in the district of Jezreel, and none shall bury her." Then the protege opened the door, and he fled. We have been noting in our study how Jehu accomplishes the fulfillment of this prophecy by a series of executions. Those that we have noted are of Jehoram, king of Israel, Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jezebel, the queen mother, and the mother of Jehoram, the mother also, I beg your pardon, the grandmother of Ahaziah, and of course the wife of Ahab. And then finally, the house of Ahab is under discussion. You will find this in 2 Kings 10, verses 1 through 11, as we have noted. Now, the way he got rid of these 70 sons, which were really accumulation of quite a number of people, and it included those of his daughters and so on. So there were some sons and all of this associated. The way that Jehu managed this is he sent these letters down to Samaria and to all of those who had authority over these, what amounted to men and boys. They were all princes. That they had to make a decision. The leaders had to make a decision. Pick one of these and put them on the throne of Israel. And then I will come do battle with him personally. Had they done that, then they would have aligned themselves with this newly appointed king, a youth, in early 20s at best, and they therefore would have associated themselves in opposition to Jehu and the prophecy of Elisha. And therefore, they determined among themselves they would not challenge him. He had already taken down two kings, and they rationalized, what could we do greater than they? So they said, "We will do anything that you tell us to do." And what Jehu said to them is, "Tomorrow morning in Jezreel, I want the heads of all 70. And they brought them in. Now you should imagine the shock that these men had in their souls at the arrival of this second missive. And they were the protectors, guardians, and in essence foster parents of these men and boys. They had been instrumental in their education and their training and were their mentors. And now they were placed in a position of executing them all and then delivering their heads to Jezreel by the next day. I have spent a lot of time in an attempt to evaluate the culture of the day, the mental attitude and disposition of the people. They had turned their backs, most all of them, on the worship of Yahweh Elohim. They had gone into the worship of Baal. I have described the horrors associated with the rituals of Baal, the murder of children, the use of drugs, the dervish dances where they would slash themselves with sharp objects, the disorientation to grace, the fear factor that motivates all of this, the sexual improprieties that went on during the worship services, all of the kinds of things that you can possibly imagine that would go against the plan of God and His system of worship were in evidence in the northern kingdom. How long those few that were left positive to the Lord and worshiped Him in His fashion as described in the law, how long, they prayed, must we endure this kind of environment? How long will these children have to be murdered as sacrifices to Baal? How long will the degeneracy continue before there will be divine intervention? So the prophecy of Elisha was given to Jehu in order to answer these prayers. The effort is to restore order in a client nation. To whom much is given, much is also required. Heathen nations carry on these kinds of behaviors constantly because they're heathen. They carry on these kinds of behaviors because they're dominated by satanic and demonic viewpoint. They carry on these things because they're vacuous within their souls and therefore are called either third world countries or, better spoken, never to be developed countries. They're that way because they have chosen to go negative at God consciousness, and therefore there's no need for a missionary and none shall be sent until there is a flare of positive volition so the Lord might guide one there. So the Lord is responsible to the believer first, and He will protect the believer by intervention into history when necessary. And if heads roll, literally or figuratively, then that is what is necessary in the angelic conflict to protect the believer, to protect his advance in the Word of God, and to resolve the angelic conflict and the appeal trial of Satan. So the resultant bloodbath was not what the Lord commanded. Jehu was assigned the duty of taking out the descendants of Ahab, not the elders and guardians. Jehu is hiding behind people in order to take care of his responsibilities, and he demands that they do so in the most grotesque fashion. Jehu delegated the task to others who felt forced to comply. Admittedly, these men were cowards, but it was not their responsibility to make this decision. It was Jehu's. Therefore, they should have refused and thus forced Jehu to do the dastardly deed. Instead, they murdered these 70 men and boys. They sent their heads to Jehu at Jezreel, and in doing so, hopefully preserved their own heads. Now, we note a principle as we resume, that those who are in positions of authority often assume their power allows them to make unilateral decisions without reference to the rules of engagement. If you have the power, then you make the decisions, and you do not consider the rules of engagement. The mandate from Elisha, take down the house of Ahab. It did not say delegate that authority to other people who were responsibility. Jehu, therefore, has decided that he has a plan, and it is all designed to secure his position as the future king of the northern kingdom. And he is going to use others in order to accomplish his political objective. So this assumption is usually permissive of the lust pattern's craving for power, which is prone to also incorporate other lust patterns. Crusader arrogance is a common result, and it is often accomplished by self-righteous arrogance. Those who believe they're right, or those who believe that the end justifies the means, develop a crusade, and the laws, the rules, the policies that are established by the collective group, meaning the nation, may be ignored because the end is greater. And those who have to be removed in some illegal or surreptitious fashion, it is all right because the end is greater. Therefore, they move forward in a crusade motivated by self-righteous arrogance and a lust for power. Unrestrained, these, therefore, can lead a person to accommodate the lust to murder, followed by the three arrogant skills. Jehu self-justified his actions with a rationale that he had to delegate the slaughter of the royal sons so order could be restored and he could govern without fear of a reckoning. If he took care of the execution of the 70, it was his idea that the people of Israel might turn against him, and therefore his coup would not be successful. He deceived himself into believing that the mandate to assassinate could be transferred to others. And he also moved into self-absorption. He intended to remove any who might be a threat to his rulership of the northern kingdom, and the royal sons of Ahab posed such a threat. And so we are reminded of Shakespeare's second part of King Henry IV, where King Henry concludes his soliloquy with the famous line, "Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown." And heads of all sorts lay most uneasily in both the northern and southern kingdoms during Jehu's rampage. 70 were lopped off on this occasion. Now note his duplicity and hypocrisy. 2 Kings 10, verse 8. When the messenger came and told him, saying, "They have brought the heads of the king's sons," Jehu said, "Put them in two heaps at the entrance of the gate until morning." That's 35 per heap. Now, I don't know how they arranged them, but I understand from my research into the ancient world that kings of this particular period made a custom of doing this after they had conquered the enemy. They would decapitate the corpses and display the heads at the city's gate in order to indicate the victory. These are the enemies. They no longer are a threat to you. We've been victorious. The phrase in this verse, "the entrance of the gate," is important in understanding why Jehu gave this order. The word "gate" is the Hebrew noun sha'ar. It means literally the main gate of the city, not just any gate, but the main gate. And we get greater details from the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, Volume 2, 945. Sha'ar, gate, is the translation. It refers to the whole gate complex and to the open area on either side of it. Now, in the ancient world, when you had walled cities, and most were if they planned to remain stable and free, you would have a wall network. I guess I should incorporate the gate. That's what we're talking about. You'd have a system sort of like this. And there would be gates here and gates here. And there would be an inner area sometimes. But there were two gates that you had to get through, this first gate and then a second one. And then there were walls, of course, that went around the entire complex of the city. There were other gates, but none were as wide as this one. This was the main gate of the city, usually to the east. And so we have the walled city being protected by this gate system, and the main gate having two gates in order to enter the city. It was the means of controlled access to a walled city. Depending on its size, a city had varying numbers of gates, but always one main gate, which often consisted of an outer and an inner gate. The city gate was extremely important in the life of the people, for social, administrative, and business intercourse took place there. Here kings, as well as city elders, sat to administer justice. Where was the courtroom in the city? If there had to be justice administered, it took place at the main gate. Everyone accumulated there in these courtyards if they were so interested. The king would be there, the judges would be there, the accused would be there, and they would hold the trial at the city gate. So the square in front of the gate was the most natural congregating place, and it was here that the prophets frequently spoke to the people, noted in 2 Kings 7:1. They would speak to the kings, noted in 1 Kings 22:10. Legal transactions took place here, according to Genesis 23:10 and 18, and it served as a marketplace as well. People would sell their wares at the main gate to the city, noted in 2 Kings 7:1. The process for administration of justice was frequently referred to by the idiom, "at the gate." And for the people of Jezreel, the elders of the city, the priests, and other officials to get the clear message that Jehu's ascendancy to the throne of Israel was secure and unchallenged, then the obvious place to display the heads of the sons of Ahab was at the gate of the city's main entrance. If you want to know who's in charge, come through the main gate. And you see, it was an agrarian society, so people would leave the city in the morning, and they would go out to their fields and crops or tend their animals, and then in the evening, they would come back and enter through the main gate. So if you want to send the message to the population, you send it at the main gate, and that's what he's doing. We also find a little bit more of information from Dr. Walberg's Bible Knowledge Commentary, Old Testament, page 557. in the ancient Near East, the practice of piling the heads of conquered subjects at the city gate was an effective way of demonstrating subjugation. In other words, do you get it? Jehu is now in charge. Most of the heads were easily recognizable to the people of Jezreel. These men and boys had grown up in the city and were well known as the children of King Ahab and subsequently of King Jehoram. The sight of the frozen death stare on their ashen faces was both shocking and frightening. Who had done such a thing and why? Jehu provided the duplicitous answer, which he calculated would defer blame from himself to the pedagogues of the now deceased royal line. 2 Kings 10, verse 9. Now it came about in the morning that he went out and stood. He's at the city gate now, and the people have accumulated there, many of them in horror, dismay, wonderment. What on earth has happened here? And why? And he stood and said to the people, well, you are all innocent. So he's done his, and the implication, I've done my investigation, there's none of you guys. So don't be fearful there will be retribution to any of you. You're all innocent. Behold, I conspired against my master. And that would be Jehoram. I am the one who took him down. I killed him. And then he says, but who killed these? Who killed these, you think? Now, are you remembering from our study Thursday and my review this morning that he ordered, in essence, ordered their pedagogues, the elders, their teachers, their trainers, their foster parents, those that had managed them from birth to become princes, that he boxed them in so that they, at least in their minds, had no choice. And so they, who had known these boys from birth, all of them got the courage to do the deed and to get it done by the next morning. No one knows how low the hearts of men will go when fear is the factor that motivates. There's some things you simply can't do. You just have to say, no, if you have to kill me, I'll be with Jesus and General Lee, but I can't stay here and take that around with my soul. And Jehu's first statement is designed to give comfort to the people by assuring them that they were not being considered as suspects for the murder of the royal line. Well, you're all innocent. I've pulled an investigation here. He admits that he is indeed the one who took out King Jehoram. Having fessed up to this, he implies the virtue of honesty. I'm admitting to you what I've done. I killed Jehoram. There's no question of that. But now he, having established his honesty about that deed, then relies upon it with his next statement. You believe that, and I believe this. He claims not only to have had nothing to do with the slaughter of the princes, but also he has no idea who did. And that's a lie. Who do you think killed these, he asks, as if he doesn't know. And the people shake their heads and say, well, we don't know. The truth is that it was by his very order that the elders and guardians had carried out the bloody deed. But by pretending he was both innocent and ignorant, he hoped to prevent anyone still loyal to the crown from leading an opposition against his coup. Many of these boys may have been very well respected by those individuals in the crowd. Some of them may have been able to become a crusader and gather a leadership, be a leader to gather a following. And there developed some kind of counter coup d'etat. He didn't want that. So he wanted these boys killed, but he didn't want their blood on his hands. So he had someone else do it, contrary to the mandate given to him by Elisha's protege. He then appeals to the divine decree, suggesting that the ghastly circumstance may be explained under the rationale, que sera, sera, what will be will be. It just, these things happen. 2 Kings 10:10. Know then, this is where he inserts the decrees. He blames God for this. Know then that there shall fall to the earth nothing of the word of the Lord. Now that is idiomatic. It means nothing shall remain unfulfilled. So let's read it that way. Know then that nothing shall remain unfulfilled. The prophecy came down, and I was delegated the responsibility of carrying forth the mechanics of the prophecy. The house of Ahab will be destroyed. Now, I don't know who did this, but it fulfills the prophecy. That's the main thing, you see. It fulfills the prophecy. And que sera, sera. What difference does it make who did it? The deed is done because nothing shall remain unfulfilled. Which the Lord spoke concerning the house of Ahab. For the Lord has done what he spoke through his servant Elijah. Now that takes you back to 1 Kings 21:17 through 29, where Elijah eats Ahab and Jezebel up one side and down the other and prophesies the demise of each. And even gets into some details. So he knows about the prophecy of Elijah. And he knows how Elisha gave him the duty of fulfilling the prophecy. Now he's associated himself with the God of the universe. He's inserted the idea that divine decrees brought this about. I have no idea how he did it. I don't know who did it. But it's not really important, is it? Because the Lord has decreed this, and it's a fulfillment of Elijah's prophecy. There's no way to get around it. So a right thing was done, but it was done in a wrong way, you see. It is true that the Lord did decree the end of the house of Ahab. However, he did not intend ruthlessness, brutality, and the macabre, camouflaged by projection, duplicity, and deceit. Further, the Lord mentioned nothing about taking out the elders, the guardians, the priests, the officials, the very ones who had been manipulated by Jehu into carrying out the mass murder of the royal line. The Lord mentioned nothing about that kind of modus operandi. However, after having identified himself with the Lord and Elijah, Jehu was able to create for himself the authority to take out the only ones who knew the truth about his treacherous scheme. He rationalized that those who knew the truth could not be allowed to stay alive. So in 2 Kings 10:11, so Jehu killed all who remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men, and his acquaintances, and his priests, until he left Ahab without a survivor. There's no one left. There's no one left to tell on him either. There was nothing in the divine decrees to kill anyone outside the house of Ahab. The elders, guardians, officials, his cabinet. This is a brain drain right here. He plans to run Israel, and he's going to do it without those who know anything about the functions of the government. Where is he going to get his knowledge as to the policies and what's been going on there? He's a military man. He doesn't know the inner workings of the government. And so he kills the cabinet, in essence. Who's going to be his advisor? They were not singled out in the prophecy. And thus Jehu went beyond his authority by including these in his purge. Jehu only possessed borrowed power to be used for a specifically stated mission. However, he used it in an unnecessary effort to gain a political advantage. He felt that he had to eliminate anyone who would be a threat to his position on the throne of Israel. Why would he think that? It's because he has no doctrine. He is able to discuss the divine decrees, but only in a manner that will cover his gluteus. He does not discuss the divine decrees in the view of the fact that God had Elisha's protege anoint him king of Israel. If he is going to be anointed king of Israel, it is God's desire he be king of Israel. It is therefore not God's desire to anoint him king of Israel, have him remove the house of Ahab, and to do it with a little bit of decency. Is he then going to allow the people to overthrow him? Would not Elisha come forward as the smoke cleared from the destruction of the house of Ahab and announce to the people, this is God's selected servant? Yes, that is the logical conclusion had Ahab, had Jehu stayed out of the way. He didn't see the decrees in that view. You see, people can come to Bible class and learn a lot of doctrine, but they don't apply it right. And Jehu's been busy being a general. He was born to Jehoshaphat. He's tribe of Judah. He is the brother of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, former king of Judah. He is in the royal line. He's a prince. And he belonged in the southern kingdom. He's the tribe of Judah. Why is he in the north, and why is he serving in the military of the northern kingdom? It's not revealed in Scripture, but we do know that he served as one of Ahab's generals. He fought in the first battle of Ramoth-Gilead. That's where Ahab was killed, in battle. And now he's just fought the second battle of Ramoth-Gilead. He's been up there a long time, and he's been an officer the entire time. And he's just been placed by Jehoram a few days ago as general in charge of the army for the battle at Ramoth-Gilead. The point I'm making to you is that this man has been fighting battles. He's been in the military for we don't know how long. It goes all the way back to Ahab's reign. What does he know about running the government? Nothing. He just wants the power. And he wants to get it in a way that no one can form a counter coup. So he just kills everybody that he thinks might mount some kind of opposition. The Lord's got, in essence, a problem with client nation Israel. I want you to know something. We're not going to do this. I have a place to stop this study. We could go on. We won't. But it would be a fascinating study because you would learn that as we continue with the northern kingdom, nobody ever gets a positive KER with the exception of Jehu for a little while. For a little while. He blows it in the end. Once he becomes king, he does some things that are totally stupid. But because he removed the horror of Ahab and Jezebel's line, because he did that deed, although wrongly in some ways, he got rid of those proponents of Baal. I've often told you what my dad has to say about my hometown. There's nothing wrong with this town that 7 or 8 funerals wouldn't cure. There's nothing wrong with this client nation that 70 or 80,000 funerals wouldn't cure. But we're not given the power or the authority, we're not delegated any of that to go out and start picking people off. That's not the way things are done. You sit back and you endure the downtimes. You endure the deviations from truth. You endure the hypocrisy and the deceit. You endure all of this because of the divine decrees. Jesus Christ controls history. Our duty is to grow in grace. And we're not to get involved in these affairs, only to observe them, to stay out of the way, to be aware, but to take no action other than to vote. What good that does. But we are to get out of the way. And Jesus Christ will not allow this client nation to go down as long as we do our duty. And he will intervene in the history. And you've seen him do it here, and some of you don't like the way he allowed things to go forward. Well, let me explain something to you. This universe was invented by God, actually Jesus Christ, in Colossians 1, 16 and 17. Why was it invented? It was invented so that the angelic conflict could be resolved. It was the human race came into existence to resolve an angelic conflict between the forces of God versus the forces of Lucifer. And we are in this game, and it has to do with an invisible war. God has no obligation to the unbeliever, none whatsoever. When they die, they go to hell, so what does it matter how they get there? Those who are believers in Jesus Christ will be protected, and when he decides to take us out, we will be in his eternal care. The issue is, will we contribute one way or the other to the success of God's victory, or will we contribute one way or the other to the defeat of Lucifer? Will you be a good soldier for Christ, or will you be involved in the losing game? Either way, know this. There is a battle going on you can't see, and you get to be a player one way or the other. You either are fighting on the side of the Lord, or you're fighting on the side of Lucifer, and there's no one who sits on the sidelines. You're engaged in this by the fact you were born. So get used to it. And when things go haywire and wrong because of the sinful natures and the lust patterns of men, when things become decrepit and degenerate and grotesque because of what mankind is willing to do to his fellow man, at some point Jesus Christ will intervene on behalf of the pivot to save your sorry souls so the Word of God can maintain its preeminence in the devil's world so you can grow in grace, and so that ultimately the victory might be won in the appeal trial. You are a player one way or the other. How long halt ye between two opinions? Jehu only possessed borrowed power to be used for a specifically stated mission. However, he used it in an unnecessary effort to gain a political advantage. If the Lord ordered him to execute the house of Ahab, he should have done it himself. Any adverse public reaction would have been handled by the Lord. Jehu thus proves the principle, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Once Jehu had secured his holdings in Jezreel, he and his men then rode off to Samaria to secure the capital. And on the way, he continued the massacre. Coming back in the second session, we will note execution of the princes royal of Judah. We will have prayer meeting at approximately 10 till the hour, and then leading off the second session, a report from Operation Iraqi Freedom from General Hal Kiesler. Enjoy your tea and crumpets.